22. Luke chapter 22. We are starting a new series, a new seven-week series today. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in just a minute. But I'm glad you're here. I don't know when the last time you went to a live sporting event, be it your favorite sport, be it a football, basketball, whatever it could be. But there's a part of those games that these people show up, okay? Everybody's favorite person, right? Here's a funny thing. Here's what happens. This is an interesting thing. I don't care what it is. It doesn't matter what level, okay? As soon as the referee or the official blows the whistle and makes a call, what does everybody do? I just got my sermon right there. Do they stand up and say, well done for the boldness of stopping the game? You showed wisdom to stop the game, to make that call, and I applaud you. Well done. Great courage. I just want to encourage you to keep doing it. Keep pressing on, ref. Keep pressing on. No, what happens? Some of you booed just in. Wow, that's my first boo. I hope it's that you boo or whatever. It's amazing. In the same call, the same incident, the same situation, whether it's 5, 10, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, in that instant, everybody's got a different perspective of the same thing. You call traveling? My baby would never travel with a basketball. That's my grandkid. Are you kidding me? We get 15 steps when we're doing layups, right? It's NBA rules. I can't believe in that. He didn't mean to spear him in that football game. He didn't mean to do that. It's funny when you bring your perspective, your angle, your little twist to the same thing, everybody can have a different perspective on the same story. Here's another couple of examples. I found this in an old picture. See the guy in there? Look at him. He's screaming out, a boat! But here we go. Turn it around. Land! Would you agree that it matters how you look at things? Would you agree with that? Here's my all-time favorite. What is that? Are you sure? Turn to somebody next to you and tell that's half of something. Tell the person next to you what that is. All right, be honest. Raise your hand if it's half full. Hands down, half empty. It's the same glass. Are you kidding me? We're supposed to be united as a church. Let's unite. Perspective matters. You may see that glass a couple of times as we go, but I want us to see something as we're going to get into this new series called Easter's Perspectives. My goal in my heart for this series, we're going to go 7 weeks. We're going to look at today. We'll be in the garden. We're going to talk about that as Craig already did in the children's sermon. And we're going to go to a couple of post-resurrection encounters with Jesus. Here's the deal, and this is kind of what I'm bringing to the table. It's sometimes I believe in my heart that Easter kind of comes and goes, and we build up, and then we go back to whatever. This series is going to start a little early, and it's going to end a little bit after. But my goal is that when we look at this Easter narrative, 7 weeks, we're going to look at snapshots, not exhaustive. We're not going to cover every little thing, so just bear with me. But snapshots of this Easter narrative. And we're going to walk through these stories, and we're going to see characters and people that you already can think of right now and looking at the same story, the same incident, the same situation, the same perspective, if you will, but they're going to hit it with different viewpoints. Without question, people view Jesus differently. They respond to Jesus differently. It depends on how they outlook on life, what they believe about Jesus, what their circumstances are. Jesus, criminal or savior. Lord or teacher. He's innocent or he's guilty. Is that Jesus or is that a ghost? The King of Kings or an imposter? Jesus, I love you, but I don't know you. Is that really you? It can't be. Selfish opportunity or grateful submission? He is risen or he was stolen? I believe. Y'all are crazy. Who is this Jesus? 7 weeks. Starting today, looking at Luke chapter 22, we're going to pick up in verse 39, a very familiar story with Jesus in the garden. My goal is to walk through it. I want us to understand some perspectives and maybe get a refocused viewpoint of what this narrative is all about. Luke chapter 22, starting in verse 39. Jesus went out as usual, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down, and prayed. "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." An angel of heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling on the ground. Stop there for just a minute. Right off the bat, I love this. Craig alluded to in the children's sermon. I love verse 39. Jesus went out as usual. I think sometimes we gloss right past that. This is not a once in a lifetime when Jesus thought this is a good opportunity to find a safe place and pray. He said he did it as usual. The King of Kings, the Messiah, the risen Lord to come, that he felt it was necessary to find a safe place to talk to his Heavenly Father. Now, right off the bat in one verse, we can already bring that perspective, and Craig mentioned the children's sermon, but us finding not just a safe place, but finding the urgency to depend and intercede, talk to the Father, and listen to the Father. Why would Jesus need to do that? He's fully God, right? He's fully man. Verse 40. He reached that place, and he said to his disciples, "Pray that you're not going to fall into temptation." And he withdrew about a stone's throw. Now, a stone's throw, it's a very loose term. Depends on how far you can throw it. I'm not going to make jokes about who could throw a stone farther, Craig. But he threw me under the bus at the 5K, so there you go. So here we go. This is what he said. He said there's a stone's throw away. And what that means is it's figurative. It doesn't matter. It's in distance where you can hear, but enough distance for solitude. Enough distance for some personal, quiet time with a father. And he knelt down, which in this time you'll be pressed to find other places in the Bible where Jesus knelt and prayed. I'm just going to throw that out there for free. You see, when you kneel, it is a sign of submission. It is a sign of a submitting of the will before someone, some authority. And Jesus knelt, as he rarely did. He knelt before the Father, and he prayed. He submitted himself, and he submitted his will, and he had an urgent request, and it's found in verse 42. He says, "Father, if there was another way, would you take this cup from me? But not my will, but yours be done." His posture is different. His urgency is different. And this typical Jewish type of posture, it was typical to be standing, but he knelt in humility and subject to authority. He addresses him as Father. He brings a condition. See, if you pray this way, is this your perspective on prayer? He says, "Father," and he brings a condition. He says, if you're willing, take this cup. He doesn't come to the Father and say, "Would you just do this?" He says, "If you're willing, take it." And there's the petition. He says, "Take this cup from me," and the submission. But he says, "Not my will, but yours be done." And so great was Jesus' agony, so great was the thought or the foreknowledge of the pain of the cross and the beatings and the torture to come. But church, I'm convinced, and people disagree on this, but I'm convinced that that wasn't the only thing he had agony on. I'm convinced that that's not the only reason that he sweat what was like drops of blood. It wasn't just pure blood. It was sweat and blood mixed, and it fell like blood on the ground. I'm convinced that that wasn't the only thing. I think he also looked, and he had the divine foreknowledge to know that he would be separated from his Father. The cross is bad enough, right? The excruciating pain and the torture and the brutality of all that entails. But I believe that Jesus also knew that he was going to have to be separated from his Father. And Hebrews 12, verse 2, reminds us that Jesus consciously, voluntarily, and obediently endured the cross, despising its shame for you and for me. But what's your perspective of the cup? What is your viewpoint? If you bring this to the table, when you read this story, have you ever thought about this, that the cup identifies as the death and the payment for sin? Have you ever thought of it this way, that that's my cup that Jesus took for me and for you? Perspective. This is not on the screen, but let me just read this to you because I love this moment. In what would seem to be the darkest hour, one of these darkest hours, Hebrews 4, verse 15 says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that you may receive mercy and find grace in your time of need." When I look at this, and I look at this perspective, and I look at this story that I've heard since I was a baby, and I can typically read this, and you could go through different the different translations or even the different gospel writings of this. Do you view the cup as yours? We have to, church. The cup is the death that he took that belongs to you and it belongs to me. And I love the fact that Hebrews reminds us that our great high priest, our King of Kings, understands, has been tempted, has been tried, yet without sin. That our God, our mediator, our Jesus understands when we have those moments as well. Father, if you're willing, would you take it away? If there's another way, if there's a way for me not to feel abandoned by you, if I don't have to endure the cross, if I don't have to bleed out and literally drowned in my blood, and I don't have to be mocked and brutally tortured in front of everybody, if there's another way, I'm in. I'm in. Is there another way? Question for you, do you think Jesus already knew the answer to that? Then why ask? You ever asked a question that you already knew the answer to? Do you think Jesus thought for a minute that maybe there's a curveball? Maybe there'll be a change of plans here. And I love how verse 43, and Luke's one of the only ones that articulates this, it says that an angel of heaven appeared and strengthened him. The anguish and the pain and the trials and the stress and the physical worry, if you will. This brutal struggle in verse 44, and we see what modern scientists would call, I'm going to mispronounce it, it's called hematidrosis or something, that's how I said it. But it's in stress or anxiety, it's where the capillaries burst and blood comes to the surface of the skin, and what all scholars agree on is that it looked like drops of blood, but it was a combination of sweat and blood. For hours, Jesus was in the garden. I'm not talking about your little five-minute devotional quiet time, you took a minute and got away with God in your quiet place and you came back, it's all good. We're talking about hours. Anguishing over what's to come, anguishing over what he knew was inevitable. But why the anguish? Take this cup, this metaphor that Jesus uses, and Scripture's riddled with that from the old and the new, separation of the Father. My perspective, when I look at this situation, when I look at this narrative, and I don't know what you bring to it, but I see a Jesus that is real. I see a Jesus that feels, hurts, is worried, is probably scared, because we want to paint a picture of Jesus that he just kind of floats in, he walks in like Braveheart or Gladiator, and he's not afraid of nobody, he's got nothing, he's going to take it all on. But we miss the sensitivity of the God-man. We miss that. He's anguishing over this. If there's another way, I will take it. And the story goes on. Let's keep going. Look at verse 45. When he arose from prayer, He went back to the disciples. About three times he did that. He went back to the disciples, and he found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow. "Why are you sleeping?" he asked them. "Get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation." Jesus has been pouring out his heart in prayer, but his disciples have fallen asleep. Now, I want to give these guys a little bit of a break here. I get a little bit defensive, kind of like when people start ragging on Thomas. I think, you know what? We're all a little bit more like Thomas than we want to be honest about. Peter, James, and John are in the garden. They're exhausted. They're worn out. They're afraid. They've been going for days and running and here and there, and they have all kinds of emotion and pain and stress and worry. They're tired. Matthew and Mark records this and says that Jesus returned three times. Why would Jesus leave them a stone's throw and come back to them to find them asleep and say, "Wake up, pray. You're going to fall into temptation, pray." And they're asleep, and they fall asleep again, and they're asleep. They're so tired, and they're so overwhelmed with worry and pain. And I want you to bring this perspective here. I want you to look at this. Have you ever been so stressed, so worried, so afraid, so scared about what's going to happen that you thought, "I'm just overwhelmed. I just want to go to sleep. I'd literally, if I could just go to sleep, I would be okay." That's where these guys are coming from. They're not just tired. They're overwhelmed with sorrow and grief. And they fall asleep. Jesus emphatically says, "Get up." He's not messing around here. He says, "Get up." He knows that they're going to need extra strength to face the temptations that are ahead of them. Maybe to run, to recant, to disbelieve, or to deny their relationship of him. Hint, hint. They're about to see Jesus brutally killed. Would they doubt him being the Messiah? So Jesus sternly asked them to pray. So church, are we prayed up? Are we asleep in the garden? Are you overwhelmed with sorrow and pain that you don't even want to pray? Could a healthy perspective of this little Easter narrative, this Easter story in the garden, remind us as a church that we need to wake up and be overwhelmed with a sense of gratitude and a willingness to come before the Father? Bring our scaredness, bring our fears and our worries and our pains. And the Lord kind of hit me with this. And if we've been in this Elephant in the Room series for about 12 weeks before this, but it hit me. This is a reality. I think there's so many in our church, maybe even here today, that you don't pray. You're figuratively asleep, if you will, because you're just overwhelmed. You don't know what to do. And you're maybe thinking, "Jesus won't answer my prayer. God won't answer my prayer. I've tried. I've done this. I just want to get past it and get through the day." I look at this and I want us to have a healthy perspective, a healthy reminder that we are to be a praying church. Followers of Jesus, as Peter, James, and John were. Followers of Jesus that pray. Followers of Jesus that obey. Are we prayed up? As, in verse 46, as he was saying these very words, if you can picture the story, if you can picture, if you've seen it, a crowd approaches. Verse 47. While he was still speaking, a crowd came. And the man who was called Judas, notice the figures here, one of the 12 was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him. That was the sign. But Jesus asked him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" When Jesus' followers saw what was going on, they said, "Lord, should we strike with our swords?" And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. But Jesus answered, "No more of this." And he touched the man's ear, and he healed him. A couple of things here. We see some perspectives. We see Judas. We see the crowd show up. We see the disciples. We see this guy named Peter. We see a man who was healed, having his ear separated from his body with a blade. Judas, with a sinful, greedy heart, came and kissed Jesus on the cheek just as he agreed. Matthew chapter 26 says, "What are you going to give me if I hand him over?" Judas made a deal. And then he had the audacity to sit at the Last Supper with Jesus. Jesus knew it. Jesus called him out on it. And he said, "Surely not me, Rabbi, surely not me." He agreed that the one he would kiss on the cheek would be the one. Imagine the intimacy. I'm not sure the last time you kissed somebody on the cheek. That's kind of awkward. Can you imagine the intimacy of Jesus? Because here's what I love. Jesus had to either turn a little bit or lean in a little bit. In the intimate betrayal of one of his followers. Now, this is the time when we want to start ripping into people and say, "Are you Judas? Have you betrayed?" All those kind of things. And I don't really want to do that today, but I want us to understand that we, just like Judas, are not above that. Judas made a deal. 30 pieces of silver, right? The church, you and I, we would never choose something other than Jesus, right? You would never betray Jesus in a way that Judas did. Satan tempted Judas, overwhelmed him, lured him with a deal. And in Matthew 26, Judas says, "What do I get? What do I get out of this if I do?" What about the crowd? Matthew, Mark, and Luke calls them great multitudes, and everybody debates on numbers. John calls it a detachment of troops, could be hundreds, if you will. They show up on the scene, and they're armed and ready to go. The disciples, they were sleepy, ready to fight, apparently. I don't know about you, but when I wake up from a nap, I'm not ready to fight anybody. Anybody awake this morning? What was their response? They just woke up from a little power nap, right, in the middle of the night. The crowd shows up, and they're ready to, "Let's do this. You want us to fight them? You want us to go after them with our swords?" And then there's the one guy. I find it humorous that I think John is the only one who outs Peter as the one who does it. All the rest of the gospel writers, even Luke says one of them or the one. Or I think John was there. He saw it. And I think he thought, "Yeah, it's Peter." Sorry, I think that's good. But Peter pulls out what would be a short sword. It wasn't the big one. He pulls out a short sword. And just a little perspective on this one. I mean, a lot of times we misteach this. We think he swung a big sword. No, he had a little one, but he got his ear. What are you aiming for if you hit his ear? Do you ever do something physically or try to do something to fix the situation because you think it's the right thing to do? I mean, I give Peter credit. He has bad aim, apparently, but I think his intentions were pure. I think it's easy to literally throw stones at this guy, but it's no different than me and my sin, where I think that I can fix it, or I think I can work hard enough, or I can work myself out of this. Perspective. What about the guy that gets overlooked in this passage so many times? What about the guy who lost his ear? His name is Malchus, or Malchus, however you want to say it. John refers to him. He's the name of the servant who got his ear cut off. Jesus healed him. Now put yourself in this story. I don't know the intentions. I don't know Malchus' story. I don't know if he's a believer. I don't know if he's curious. I don't know what. But I'll tell you this, church. If you get your ear cut off and somebody who professes to be this King of Kings, this Messiah guy, and he does a little, like he's going to pull something out of your ear, but he pulls his hand back and your ear's there again. Whoa. Perspective. Look at this. Imagine when they arrest him and take him back. Can you picture Malchus literally doing this and going, "Dude, it was gone. It is back. He healed it." That Peter guy's nuts. He's crazy. He cut my ear off. He's got horrible aim. But Jesus put his hand right there, and it's back. I'm pretty sure it was dark, but I know it's back. Do you think he's really the guy? Do you think this Jesus thing is legit? They didn't probably use that word. But do you think it's a real thing? Do you think Jesus is true? Do you think it's authentic? Because he healed my ear. It's back. Do you think he was mad? Do you think he was worried? Do you think, should we let him go? Did you see what happened? Perspective. Jesus told him to stop. He could call down angels, legions. But I get goosebumps here because this is where I love, because here's the truth. He could call angels. He could stop it. He could do just like that, and it's done. But church, there is a plan in place. God has a plan in place to redeem us. Matthew chapter 26 says, "Do you not think that I could call on my Father, and he will at once at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then could the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way?" I could stop this like that, but how is it going to take place? How is this redemption? How is this cup of death that every one of us deserve, how are they going to be saved? There is no other way. John chapter 18 says Jesus commanded Peter to put your sword away. Shall, 1811, if you want to look it up, shall I not drink the cup the Father has given to me? I love this story because I don't want to just gloss over it. Jesus in a second could have stopped it, but he knows the Father has a plan. He knows from the creation of man that where there's going to be a Genesis 3 world, that people are going to be broken by sin, this world is going to be fractured and frayed and need to be redeemed. And the only way to redeem mankind is if God steps in and he chose to step out of heaven and take on flesh and walk for 30 years on this earth and get to this point when there was a decision to make. And he says, "Father, I will take the cup because there's no other way. There's no other way." Verse 52, if you want to look at your Bibles, look what happens. Then Jesus says to the chief priest, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had all come for him, in addition to all the soldiers, "Am I leading some rebellion that you would come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, yet you did not lay one hand on me. But this, this is your hour when darkness reigns." You see, the soldiers wouldn't arrest Jesus in the temple out of fear for a riot. They did it in darkness. They did it under compulsion of Satan himself. It would appear as though in strong, dark places that they would come from. But our sovereign God is unfolding the redemption of man. I want you to see, church, this calculated love story where God is redeeming us and faced with this darkest of times, Jesus prayed and he took the cup that you and I deserve. It would seem that darkness would win. It would seem that in this hour that what is going to take place is a tragedy. It would seem if you were Peter, James, and if you were John, that your perspective as they lead him away to be in prison and then we see what's going to happen next. Do you remember what he said? Pray that you're not tempted. When they walk him away, can you imagine those three guys? They're leading our Messiah, our leader, our rabbi, our teacher. They're taking him away. And if you're like me, you know what I do? My wife knows this. The two words I struggle with the most when it comes to any situation is, well, what if? What if he's not who he says he is? What if he doesn't come back? What if? Church, what's your what if? Easter's coming. We're not even there yet. Easter's on its way. But I want to ask you, what's your perspective? Because when difficult, trying times come, we have lots of what ifs. Jesus had to die. He had to partake of the cup so that we might live. Eternity in the balance. The only ransom for sin. The only way for us to be right with the Father is for Jesus to submit and to take the cup. I want us to see some perspectives here as we kind of close this up. I want us to see that we can learn so much from Gethsemane. We can look at this, and it's more than just a prayer. It's more than just the disciples. But everybody on this same story is pulling different perspectives. Malachus, James, Peter, John, Jesus, the crowds. Malachus, the guy with his ear, I think I mentioned him. All these people. Same event, same story. Different perspectives, different viewpoints. Is he Savior? Is he really God? He healed my ear. Is he coming back? Do we believe? Are we a praying people? What about Judas? We're like Peter, we want to muster through and fight. How do you view Jesus in this? What is your perspective of this Easter narrative, this story? I want to share one last scripture with you. It's not going to be on the screen, but I want you to bear with me. I want you to picture what we just talked about. The author of Hebrews in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7 says this. See if this sounds familiar. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Son, though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who would obey him. That's why Jesus prayed. That's why he submitted, because he looks up to the heavens, just as that picture shows. He looks up to the heavens and he's saying, Father, is there another way? He looks up to the heavens for hours. Now, I'm not the smartest person in the room, but I'm going to tell you this. I think part of the reason he was there for hours is because he's waiting. He's waiting for God the Father to respond. And he looks up to the heavens and he looks up desperate. And you know what he hears from the heavens? That's exactly what he hears. He's waiting. Hours. And I'm convinced that the reason he goes back to those disciples, those guys, to check on them and check on their well-being, but have you ever needed to be encouraged and then go back at it? And he comes back to talk to the guys and prayed up, the temptation is coming, but he goes back and he's waiting in silence. And church, here's the reality of this. Do you know what the silence was? The silence was more than just an absence of a voice. Three times he comes back, and three times he waits, but the silence in the cold air of the night was an unmistakable no. Are you with me? It's a no. We want to look at this and say, well, Jesus was praying, but God was silent because of the plan. No, the silence of God in this question when Jesus says, if there's another way, and he looks up and the angel, yes, strengthened him, but the answer was emphatically no. There is no other way. Because we need the high priest, as Hebrews 2 says, who can sympathize with our weaknesses. We need the only mediator, as Hebrews 4 says, to come in and redeem us. Hebrews 2 says Jesus is the only atonement sacrifice. God has to say no. God said no to demonstrate his justice and righteousness. He cannot let sin go unpunished. He can't just say, Jesus, you get a pass. We'll figure out another way. He did it for the mutual glory. You can read on later on if you want to. In John 17, it says, when Jesus says, Father, the time has come to glorify your Son so that the Son can glorify the Father. The Father and the Son, mutual glorification in this moment. Luke 9:22 says, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders. See if this sounds familiar. The elders and the chief priest and the teachers of the law. He must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Because the Father said no, sinners like me and sinners like you, we have a high priest, a great high priest in Jesus. Because the Father said no, we have Jesus who stands in the gap to atone for the sins of man. Because the Father said no, Jesus took the cup that was for me. Because the Father said no, we will also get to forever enjoy him in eternity. Same story. How many times have you read this story? How many times have you taught this story to your kids? How many times have we glossed past this and we pull a little nugget here and a little nugget here? Here's what my prayer for today is very simple. I'm not thinking that anything today was mind-blowing. I've never heard that before, Pastor. That's amazing. That's new information. The reality is simply this, that as we approach getting closer and closer to Easter, and people's affections for the things of God sometimes become a little bit rekindled. I don't know where you are or what you're going through, but I want you to look at this. Everybody who can hear this sermon, to look at this story, look at Gethsemane, look what Jesus and all of the key players, everything that they bring into it as a perspective. Why Jesus was told no, why he prays, why he wanted the cup taken away. Judas, Malachi, Peter, James, John, all saw the same thing. I want us to see as we start this whole thing, and I hope you come back, and if you're passing through, I hope you come back. I want us to see with fresh eyes the beautiful story of redemption. It's beautiful. There's a reason why Jesus did this. There's a reason why he was told no. There's a reason why he was struggling. And as we keep going, we're going to see this grand love story of God. And you know who it's for and about? You. It's me. So if that's not enough to hook you to come back next week, I don't know what is. This is about you. This is your story. This is your celebration. This ought to be at the front of our minds and the tip of our tongue to say, hey, this is what it's all about. May we celebrate, not just for the next 7 weeks, but may we celebrate, and not just on Easter Sunday, but may we celebrate this grand redemptive story, and may we look at all these characters of the same story and see with a refocused of this glorious, wonder, amazing redemption story of God. Would you pray?